It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, Starbucks says it will eliminate drinking straws by 2020 in an effort to cut back on plastic pollution. But our guest says the decision will have unintended consequences for people with disabilities. First, the Trump administration is no longer allowed, at least for now, to deport parents whose children were separated from them at the U.S.-Mexico border. Yesterday, a federal judge in San Diego hit the pause button on a part of the president's zero-tolerance border policy. After the administration missed a court-imposed deadline last week to reunite all kids under five with their parents, the judge said changes have to be made to ensure the other 2,600 minors are reunited with their families by July 26th. Alan Gomez is an immigration reporter for USA Today. Alan, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Well, who does this new order apply to, this order from a judge?
It applies basically to the entirety of the federal government, but very specifically to Immigration and Customs Enforcement, who are the ones that would carry out the deportations of these parents.
And which parents will be affected by it?
Basically, every parent that's been separated from their child as part of this quote-unquote zero-tolerance policy of the Trump administration. What was happening and the reason the judge issued this order is that the judge had ordered all of the families to be reunited, but what the government was planning to do in many of these cases was reunite them for just a very brief period of time and then give the parent an option. You can either go be deported back to your home country together, or the parent could be deported alone and the child could stay in the United States and try to fight for some kind of legal status. The ACLU, who brought this lawsuit, complained that they were doing this in a very, very quick way, that there was rumors of mass deportations happening once all these reunifications happened. And the judge, I think out of just an abundance of caution, just kind of put the pause on that and said, let's give this a little bit more time. Let's give them a little bit of breathing room to make these decisions. And so we have this 1 week pause, and we should get another answer from the judge next Monday once they have a little more time to talk it out.
Is the ACLU arguing that parents need this time to try to get some kind of legal representation if they're going to apply for asylum status?
That too, yeah. I mean, it's basically just saying, you know, a couple of hours isn't enough time to sort of decide the rest of your life. There are many options available to these immigrants, and the ACLU is contending that the government isn't being totally forthcoming when it comes to all the options available to these folks. So they're trying to get all these. There's all sorts of attorneys who are trying to offer their services pro bono. Some of these immigrants do have their own counsel. And these kids, that's a whole other issue, they do have some sort of rights to some sort of protection from the Department of Health and Human Services to help them out with their cases. And basically the ACLU is saying, yes, everyone needs more than just a few hours to make these kind of decisions and needs a little bit of input from some kind of immigration attorney or somebody who knows what they're talking about.
Now, there are a lot of people still covering this story, but it's not the top headline news it was just a couple weeks ago. How many kids are still separated from their parents at this point? Do we know? Do we have a solid number?
Well, as of yesterday, the government has identified roughly 2,600 children that were separated from their parents. The first round of all this was trying to reunite children under the age of five. That ended up being 57 children, and those reunifications finished last Thursday, about 2 days after the court's deadline to reunify that first group. But now we're in the middle of this much larger group of 2,551 children between the ages of 5 and 17 that all now have to be reunited with their parents by July 26. There's a lot of hiccups along the way. These court hearings have been pretty contentious at times, with the government asking for more time and the judge being very clear that his deadlines, as he put it, were not, they were firm deadlines, not aspirational goals, and really pushing the government to make these happen and to improve the process, to speed these reunifications up, and finally leading to this sort of pause in at least the deportations. But the reunifications have to continue throughout this process.
What was the argument from the government? In this case, I think it's the Department of Health and Human Services. What were they arguing to Judge Dana Sabraw about why they wanted more time, or they wanted a later deadline?
Well, from their perspective, they're just trying to make sure that they're returning each child with a parent. You know, to hear the ACLU say, to characterize this, well, you separated them, you should be able to reunite them. And it sounds relatively simple to say, okay, we separated these two people, reunite them, hurry up, do it quick. The problem is, it's become incredibly clear throughout this lawsuit that the Trump administration never created any kind of formalized system to, you know, match up a parent who is in either ICE custody or being held in a federal prison somewhere with a child that is being held by the Department of Health and Human Services. So they had to start from scratch, and they had to start going literally case by case, going through each file to figure out which child corresponded to which parent. And then what HHS is saying and why they claim that they need more time is that they then need to take several steps to make sure that that person is the parent. So in many cases, they've been using DNA testing to ensure that that was the parent, and they've stated that at least two or three cases have shown that, no, it wasn't the parent. It was somebody who was posing to be the parent. They say that they need to do background checks on these parents that they're being ordered to reunite them with, and in several cases they found situations where the parent is now either in state or federal custody on a non-immigration criminal charge, including murder, including child abuse. So they're saying, no, we're not going to reunite them with those kind of parents. And so they say they just need time to really sort this through, to figure out that the parents really are the parents of the children, and that these parents do not pose a danger to these children. So they say that process is a time-consuming one that usually takes months when they go through it. But the judge is saying that, no, that you need to do it quickly and you need to do it effectively. And so that's why he's maintained with his deadlines.
Alan Gomez is with us, immigration reporter for USA Today, looking at a ruling from a judge stopping, at least for the moment, deportations of parents of children who are separated from their families at the U.S. border, and more generally at this story of family separation. Alan, this burst in family separation happened not as a direct policy, right, but as a consequence of this zero tolerance policy saying, hey, we're charging you with the crime if you come in at the border. Parents were charged with crimes as a consequence, separated from their kids. What's happening now? If a family comes in, are they being separated? How's that being treated with new arrivals now?
Well, the president, when faced with all the backlash from people and both sides of the aisle, what he did was he stopped the zero tolerance policy. So and basically you're right and exactly right in how you explained it. It's not that they came. It's not like the Trump administration came in and said, we're going to start just tearing apart families. What they did was. They started criminally charging everybody who illegally crosses the border. Previously, the majority of people who illegally cross the border, it's treated like a civil violation. You're ordered to appear in court. You're released until your court hearing. And so people were allowed to stay together in the U.S. while they awaited their deportation hearing. But what the Trump administration did was implementing this zero tolerance policy was deciding to charge all of them criminally, which then forces them to transfer the parents into either Bureau of Prisons facilities or adult immigration detention to sit there until their deportation hearing. And we have a series of U.S. laws and court rulings that require that children can't be in that kind of situation. So then they are separated. So what the Trump administration has said is they're going to stop those separations. They're no longer criminally charging all these parents who are coming over. So for the time being, those separations are not supposed to be happening, and we see no indication that they are. But yes, this does raise that longer term question, and it's something that Congress is definitely trying to take a look at, and especially Republicans in Congress are trying to figure out a way to, you know, deter people from coming here as families, but at the same time make sure that those families aren't separated in the manner that they have been for these last few months.
Yeah, we hear that today three Democratic senators unveiled a Reunite Act aimed at immediately reunifying all these families and then creating a permanent system of coordination among government agencies to track when, I guess, kids are separated from their parents, if and when that happens. What else is going on in Congress? What are the Republican majorities doing on this?
Well, right now, nothing. These Democrats filed this bill, and like you said, it has all sorts of mechanisms to protect these families and to make sure that these separations don't happen. One of the provisions in this bill would require the agency to, you know, just completely wipe out these DNA tests that they've collected to make sure that information isn't used later for immigration enforcement purposes. But again, these are three Democrats and three Democrats. You know, odds are that bill's not going to get very far in this Senate. And by and large, Congress has, you know, tried a couple of times over this year to kind of wade into this debate. Remember, we still have the looming issue of the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program. That's about 800,000 young undocumented immigrants whose futures are in limbo right now and will ultimately be decided by the Supreme Court later this year. So there's a lot of issues that are before this Congress and that require congressional action, but the last time they tried anything was several months ago. They didn't get very far, I think for most Republicans, they are more than happy to get through this election season without having to have a very long, contentious immigration debate on the floor of either chamber. So I don't really see anything coming anytime soon. We might see some efforts from Republicans to try to clean up this practice that we're seeing with family separations, but anything, the simplest of immigration laws has proven just incredibly difficult to get through this Congress or any in recent years. So I don't really see much happening over the course of the summer.
Now, we got, Alan, these 2,500 plus kids around the country, I guess, waiting for reunification, maybe by that deadline, July 26th. Where are they right now?
Well, the way it works is the Department of Health and Human Services, it's not like they have their own facilities. They contract out to a variety of shelters around the country. So those kids are spread out all over the country. But what they have been doing in the past couple of weeks is starting to pre-position some of these children to make these reunifications a little bit quicker. The government has stated that they're going to set up about 6 to 8 different, you know, sort of processing centers for these reunifications to happen. At least a couple of them will be in southern Texas. I believe one of them is going to be in Arizona, probably one in California, and maybe a couple spread out throughout the Midwest to make it easier to spread these out a little bit. But they're basically pre-positioning them not to get too far in the weeds here, but there are certain facilities that are approved for families to stay together, for children to be there as well as adults. So those are going to be the ones that are most heavily used. And the idea is that they will kind of go through these, and it'll be almost like an assembly line, just kind of, all right, reunite the parent, make sure that's the right one. Okay, here we go. All right, next one. And so that they can kind of quickly go through these. The ACLU has been requesting that they be alerted of every reunification that happens so that they can have, faith-based groups and immigration advocacy groups there standing by to help them, you know, get a hotel room when they're released or just help them get a meal or just make sure that they have some of the basic needs covered once they're released. That has proven to be a little bit of a fight in the court hearings. But I think right now they're kind of setting up that process so that it all happens at about, right, 6 to 8 different facilities to make things go as smoothly as possible.
And briefly, Alan, as we wrap up, there were concerns about the conditions kids and youth were being held in. What's the latest on that in our last minute or so?
Yeah, I mean, that's one of those that, you know, a lot of members of Congress asked for and received tours of a lot of these shelters. There have been accusations that these kids have been treated almost like criminals, to hear some people who've been through it describe it. I haven't really seen any kind of lawsuit or anything definitive on that yet. So for now, I think we need a little bit more information as these kids start getting out of there and we start hearing more of their stories to determine if these facilities really were, you know, treating them well or if there's going to be some sort of follow-up investigation to see what these shelters are like moving forward.
Alan, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Rob, thank you. Appreciate it.
That's Alan Gomez, immigration reporter at USA Today. We talked with him about a federal judge's order temporarily blocking the Trump administration from deporting parents who had been separated from their kids at the U.S.-Mexico border. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, middle-class American families are having trouble keeping up with the costs of raising children, according to our guest, the author of the new book, Squeezed. Right now, Starbucks made headlines recently when it announced that it would eliminate plastic drinking straws by 2020. There are also some local governments like Seattle that have already made a move to ban single-use plastic straws. Others, including Chicago, are considering joining them. Many hail this as a good move to reduce plastic waste that impacts the environment and oceans in particular. But members of the disability rights community have raised concerns that there are people who need those straws and that alternatives pose risks. They also say that this is just the latest in a long line of policy decisions that are made without consulting people with disabilities, even though they may be affected. Karen Hitzelberger has a postgrad diploma in disability studies from the University of Leeds in England. She has cerebral palsy and wrote a recent piece for the Washington Post titled "Plastic Straw Bans Are the Latest Policy to Forget the Disability Community." Karen, welcome to Central Time.
Yeah, great to be here.
Let's talk about this straw. We've lost our audio on that interview with Karen Hitzelberger. We'll try to get that back later in the show. Hopefully we'll get that back and play it maybe on another day or later on the show. But right now, you can weigh in on this issue. Have you heard about this straw bans at places like Starbucks? That's the biggie. You probably have seen one or two of those around. They're saying, hey, we're going to work to get rid of straws in our establishments. Local government's doing the same. What do you think about this idea? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. What are the pros and cons of getting rid of plastic straws at restaurants, coffee shops, you name it? Should it be done for environmental reasons? Are you a person like the guest who we'll hopefully hear from later this week who rely on drinking straws maybe because of a disability of your own? Again, call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Weigh in on this issue. Do you want your local restaurant chain, whatever, to do something on this issue to ban the straw? Go to your calls now. Mona is with us in Madison. Mona, hi.
Yeah, I think it's a terrific idea. They've been doing this in Europe for a while now, and not just straws, but all kinds of plastic, extraneous plastic wrap and everything else, and it's really making a difference. And as far as people needing straws because of a disability or whatever, I've been bedridden several times and used straws when I'm in bed, and I've invested in a set of stainless steel ones. They last forever. You just throw them in the dishwasher, and, you know, they're great. You can carry one with you if you need it when you go out. So I don't see that that's really an issue.
Mona,
that's my take on it.
Mona, thanks for the call. We'll go next to Tia on the line in Green Bay. Tia, hi.
Hi. My husband and I eliminated straws from our bed and breakfast years ago, and we switched over to recycled paper straws. And for our personal use, we use metal straws, which we then clean in a mild bleach solution after we use them. And it's been no problem for us whatsoever, and we feel better about not adding more plastic to the landfill.
I gotcha. Tia, I want to ask, I'm not super familiar with the metal straws on the market or the paper ones. One concern for people with disabilities is that, you know, bendy straws were actually invented for people with disabilities. It's needed for some people in wheelchairs and other situations to be
sure.
able to get to that drink. Are any of those available in bendy form?
They most certainly are. The metal straws come already bent, so they have just a slight curvature in them in order to accommodate someone with a disability.
All right, Tia, thank you so much for sharing the story at Your Bed and Breakfast. We'll go next to Mary Kay on the line in Kenosha. Mary Kay, hi.
Hi. Paper straws should be allowed, and they should make them bendable.
Okay. But you want to see plastic go away for plastic straws
yes,
in restaurants?
Yes, I do.
All right, Mary Kay, thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234, talking about the idea of banning plastic straws. Starbucks says they're moving away from them. Some cities are looking at local bans as well. You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Do you think straws should be banned for environmental reasons? Do you appreciate their convenience? If you're a person with a disability, do you rely on them to be able to get access at your local restaurant or coffee shop? Steve is next in Racine. Steve, hi.
Hey there, how are you today?
Good, what do you think?
Well, a couple different things. Number one, it's a known fact that of the in the ocean plastic waste, the 90% of it is coming from 10 rivers. None of them are in the Western developed world. So we're talking about a tiny fraction of waste coming from America and Western Europe. The second thing is that Reason Magazine did a study on the new covers that Starbucks had to implement to adapt to their paper straws or to the new straws that they're going with. And the plastic covers actually have more plastic in them. So all of this is very nice. It's a good thing to try to save the environment, but we have to do it intelligently and not just ways that are virtue signaling.
Steve, thanks.
Sorry, that's just my opinion.
No, that's fine. Steve, thanks for calling in. We'll go next to Mary Lisa in Shawano. Mary Lisa, hi.
Hi.
Hi, what do you think?
I'm all for this. My family and friends have gone to campaigning against use of single-use plastics, and the number one is plastic straws. So when we go to restaurants or anywhere, we make sure and bring our own stainless steel straws and ask that we not be, any of our drinks be polluted with straws. I disagree with your earlier caller. This is a huge problem, and there's a wonderful company that you could put a link up called 4Ocean, the number 4Ocean, and they are pulling pounds and pounds and pounds of plastic out. They're just getting ready to pull their 1 millionth pound of plastic out of the ocean.
Mary Lisa, thanks for the call. I want to bring on one more caller before we're out of time. Rob is with us in Winona, Minnesota. Rob, hi.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good. What do you think?
Well, I mean, straws are an issue. I don't deny that. But my issue is that I drink an awful lot of apple juice, and the only way I know how to buy it is in plastic bottles. And I don't want to buy it in plastic bottles, but I don't find any alternative.
So you're hoping to find plastic replacement. Rob, thanks a lot for all of your calls, and we'll air that interview with Karen Hitzelberger at our earliest opportunity, talking about issues for people with disabilities if straws aren't available at restaurants and coffee shops. First, membership in the middle class has historically been seen as a pretty comfortable life in the United States. People in the middle class could generally assume that they would have a higher standard of living than their parents, that investing in a good education would pay off, and that being able to afford to have a family would be a given. But our next guest says that has changed, and many in the middle class are facing a more and more precarious financial reality. Alyssa Court is the executive editor, and co-founder of the journalism nonprofit, The Economic Hardship Reporting Project. She's the author of several books, and her latest is called Squeezed, Why Our Families Can't Afford America. Alyssa, welcome to Central Time.
Oh, it's great. It's great to be on.
Well, use the term middle precariat to describe the group of people that you're talking about, the people you talk to feeling pressure from all sides, feeling squeezed. How does that phrase, middle precariat, sum up the people you're talking about here?
So this is what I saw in my reporting, and when I looked at the numbers, middle class used to mean stable, right? Almost humdrum. It was a regular job with regular hours and maybe a pension. You weren't reaching for the stars, but you were secure. Now it often means unstable jobs. You're squeezed both in terms of your money and your emotions. It's not being able to live with dignity and security.
And this really gets bad, you say. People really feel squeezed after the birth of a child, starting with the expenses of the birth of a child. Can you talk about how that's starting to affect people?
Yeah. So, I mean, I was just looking at the cost, literally, of labor around the world. And in the U.S., it could be $16,000 for a C-section, let's say. And then in other countries, it was something like $3,000. And just that. That alone was a real issue for many of the people I spoke to. If there was any complications, even when they had health insurance, they'd be in debt after giving birth.
And these costs for this middle class group, often on top of a lot of student debt already.
Right. So, yeah, student debt is piling up. It's leading to people reconsidering having children at all. You know, there was that new study by the CDC, the data that women were having fewer children than at any point since 1978. That's 1.76 children over their lifetimes, down from 2.1 in 2007. And that's right, of course, right before the recession. That's a key number, right? So I think people are thinking, I have all this student debt. I have, you know, some of the people I spoke to had $140,000 in student debt. You know, how are they going to pay that back and have two children or even one child and indeed pay for daycare and housing?
Right. You quoted one, I think one mom saying her long-term financial plan was to stop at one kid.
Yeah, exactly. Stop it. That was my family's plan as well.
And talk about how this weighs on people emotionally. And we'll talk a lot about the financial elements and the work and work-life balance elements here. But there's a lot of anxiety among the people in the middle class that you talk to.
Yeah, I think there's this worry about the future. You know, what's your life trajectory? So, yeah, I see squeezed as a financial phenomenon, but it's also a psychological and almost an existential one. Whereas, you know, these jobs, being a librarian or a teacher, professor, even a lawyer used to have this regularity to it. Now it's sort of what is going to happen? What, not only what's my old age going to look like, what's my middle age going to look like? Am I going to have, you know, money for vacations? Am I going to have money to pay for a mortgage? So it really changes the nature of how people see themselves. And that, of course, produces anxiety. It's also intergenerational. I think people, I've even at events I've done since the book has come out, people will stand up and they'll say things like, I was, you know, I tried to explain to my parents, you know, they're people in their 30s and 40s. They try to explain to their parents in their 70s what their life, what it takes to live a middle class life. And there's a real discrepancy intergenerationally.
Talking to Alyssa Quart, author of the new book, Squeezed, Why Our Families Can't Afford America. And staying on the, I guess, the feelings side of this, Alyssa, a lot of feelings of guilt, that's an individual failing to not have the security, and blame, whether that's self-blame or blame of something else, someone else.
Yeah, so I think that was part of one of my readings of what happened in the election even in 2016, because I feel like some of the people I spoke to were blaming themselves, but I know that many people who were struggling or on that sort of edgy middle-class identity blame others. They blame immigrants. They're Islamophobic. And one of the things I hope to do with this book and just these conversations we're having and conversations I hope people start having is looking for system fixes, looking for the system problems of why people are where they're at, so they don't blame themselves and they don't blame other groups of people.
Right. That's, if there's a running theme in your book or many running themes, that's one of them, the idea that from the perspective of one person or one family, this is an individual personal problem. But when it's happening again and again and again, you say this is some kind of structural problem. There's something bigger going on than one person's life decisions.
Yeah. And people, the people I spoke to, you know, I some of them I call the hyper-educated poor. You know, they have graduate degrees. They felt like they did everything right. And so they even know they're not supposed to be blaming themselves, you know, but they're like, what's wrong with me? You know, they'll just say that after, you know, a couple conversations. They'd say, you know, why am I not able to make this work? And that was very striking to me. And sometimes I'd want to pipe in and say, and sometimes I did. I said, there's nothing wrong with you, or you've tried the best you could, you know. And the right response to where they're at is rage and reorganization and trying to rethink why we don't have things like paid family leave and all the rest.
Let's talk about that. There has been talk about trying to expand paid family leave in the United States. First of all, how does the U.S. compare to other developed, if we want to call them that, countries when it comes to family leave?
Oh, absolutely terribly. I mean, for one thing, you know, when I if we're just talking about things like daycare, you know, I went to Montreal and it was daycare costs $7 to $20 a day versus in the U.S. where it was, you know, there are people who I spoke to were spending 30% to even 38% of their incomes on daycare. And then in terms of maternity leave, you have 14% of the American workforce that gets paid family leave versus, you know, in multiple other countries, weeks and weeks of paid family leave and pregnancy leave as well.
And another issue when it comes to childcare is predictability. If you work a predictable 8 to 4, 9 to 6, whatever schedule, childcare is one thing. If you're working different times a day, working overnight, all of a sudden 24-hour random access childcare becomes an issue. What are people doing?
So, yeah, so one chapter of my book, I look at what I call extreme daycare, and that's daycare that is happening in the evenings and on weekends and sometimes even overnight. And there was a study then that showed that today 9% of daycare services are being provided in these off hours, which would imply that people are working, you know, really strange clocks. I call them the forever clock. So it's like, you know, when do they stop working? When can they? How many jobs do people have to do to pay for pay for, to have kids in this country. I embedded myself in one of these 24/7 daycares, and it was fascinating because, I mean, the kids were great. It was a sweet place. There was nothing wrong with it, but, you know, they were picked up sometimes at 10 o'clock at night, or, you know, they were dropped off early in the morning, or their parents would come at various strange times during the day. And the reason that was happening was because they were given only a certain amount of working hours that were completely not thinking about the workers as human beings and parents. So they'd be given teeny little slivers of work hours, and then they'd have to drop their kids at daycare to make sense of those hours they were being assigned.
And you say there's a fundamental issue of us devaluing the role of caregiving in the United States, whether that's the parent themselves or, say, somebody works at a child care and is paid not much in maybe a very expensive city to live in.
Yeah. So one thing I hope also to get across is that we do need to reframe care. You know, right now, with the paradox is that so many parents are spending so much of their money on daycare, but then the daycare workers themselves are really struggling. So I try to represent their experience as well. I didn't want it to just be one of those like privileged mom books or, you know, struggling privileged mom books. I wanted to show the workforce that's actually propping up some of those parents too and how much they're struggling. So there's a real disconnect. I mean, obviously what we need are more universal pre-K. We need more subsidized daycare for people who are not under the poverty line, you know, who are just holding on. So this is something I saw a lot of.
We're talking to Alyssa Quart right now about her most recent book. It's called Squeezed: Why Our Families Can't Afford America. She's the executive director and co-founder of the journalism nonprofit, the Economic Hardship Reporting Project. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Is this you? Is this your family? Do you feel squeezed? What are the main issues for you having a hard time making ends meet, maybe even let alone getting ahead? How different has it been for you compared to, say, your parents' generation? Do you feel this guilt or self-blame for not being able to keep up maybe with the daily bills, the cost of childcare, housing, and more? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Right now, we pick up the conversation with Alyssa Quart. Her new book is called Squeezed: Why Our Families Can't Afford America. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you feel squeezed in your family budget, in your family time? Is it hard for you to find, to afford, say, childcare? How are you balancing work, a family, and the costs associated with trying to have both? Call 800-642-1234. And are you in a situation where you are putting off or maybe changing your mind about having kids due to the costs associated with child raising? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Alyssa, another issue I want to get into is the cost of housing. We hear again and again about, okay, the communities that have great jobs, maybe middle class pay type jobs, are in places where the middle class can't afford to live in them.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I talked to somebody who lived in the deep Midwest in an icy small town, and she was saying, "Oh, I'm not getting the work that, you know." She was a graphic artist. I'm not getting the work I need out here, you know. And that's one of the prices that people pay. So then they start moving it to cities. They move to near San Francisco or New York if they're in any of these kind of creative or so-called, you know, professions, media professions, right? And then they can't afford the housing that goes along with it. One chapter in my book is about school teachers outside San Francisco and places like San Jose who drive Uber. They drive Uber after work and on weekends, and they're doing that because they're having trouble paying for their apartments. One-bedroom apartment in San Francisco averaged $3,500 a month. So that was, you know, he was driving his Uber instead of preparing his curriculum.
Let's go to our callers now. Carol is with us in Wausau. Carol, hi.
Hi.
What do you want to tell us about, Carol?
I just wanted to make the comment that as a parent and grandparent and someone who has worked all my adult life, that in having children and looking for daycare, that it certainly has been an issue, both in availability as well as cost. However, I do want to comment that being a parent is a choice. And when you have children, one of your considerations should be, can I afford the cost of raising that child, including daycare and housing and all the other things that go with it. So again, I am sympathetic to the issue, but I also would like to point out that parenting, being a parent and choosing to be a parent, has its responsibilities and the costs that come with it.
Carol, thanks a lot for that call. And Alyssa, that cost is changing, you write, and you write that a lot of people are making that decision now to maybe not have kids solely or mainly because of those cost issues.
Yeah, I mean, I do understand what the caller's saying, and I challenge some of the things that some of the people in my book, including myself, were told. We were told, do what you love and follow your dreams as a worker. And these are things we need to start rethinking, and we need to start rethinking whether we go to graduate school, whether we do all these things and, you know, mount this debt before we have children. By the same token, I don't know how many of the people who, in fact, did do everything right, as it were, how they could do differently. I mean, they're spending every last dime on daycare and after school care in order to work, in order to support the family. So it's a vicious cycle.
Carol, thanks for that call. I'll go next to Margaret in Milwaukee. Margaret, hi.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call.
What do you think, Margaret? What did you want to tell us about?
Well, I have a 4-year-old and I have an 8-month-old, and I can really relate to what you're talking about. Our situation that we've experienced recently with my second daughter, I was on bed rest for 14 weeks. And that was totally unexpected. You know, we knew that kids were expensive, but, like, it was expensive in a different way because my husband had to quit his job to take care of us and hasn't really gotten back into the workforce since, even though he's been trying to. So, it's a really, really difficult time, and we're feeling that squeeze. We have lots of ways that we try to make money go farther, but it's been a real, real challenge, not just having little kids, but having little kids and having no money.
Margaret, thank you so much for sharing that story. And Alyssa, one of the first people you talk about in the book, they're in a situation, I think, where they say, you know, if everything goes just right and nothing goes wrong, we can get by, but there's always something that could go wrong.
Yeah, exactly. And I'm just thinking about the one small medical thing that goes wrong, and then your husband or your wife is forced to be a child, you know, both a child care and a spouse care provider. And that's where pregnancy leave or maternity leave is even more necessary, right? Because those things do come up. I mean, I was just going to say, for new parents in England, you get 280 days of, you know, parental leave at 90% pay, and Canada 119 days at 55% pay. So, you know, I also had, you know, hyperemesis, which when I was pregnant, I was not in great shape after my daughter was born because I'd been sick for all those months, just like you. And so those days of leave would sure have been come in handy.
Thanks for the call, Margaret, and good luck. We're talking to Alyssa Court, author of the new book, Squeezed, Why Our Families Can't Afford America. Back to your calls, Lee in Glidden. Lee, hi.
Hi. Mine's kind of a different thought on this. I consider myself a part of the middle class, lucky that I don't feel squeezed. But my observation has been that the problem goes deeper than this, and I think it goes down to Americans don't care about other Americans anymore. You know, why don't we have maternity leave and daycare and health insurance for everyone? It's because I don't want to pay more taxes because I got to have more for me. So in Europe, they're not doing that. They care more about the society.
Thanks for the call. Alyssa, what do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I definitely think there's a sense that we're supposed to take care of ourselves. It's a sort of ruthless individualism. And it's not just, you know, bootstrapping. It's also, you know, as women workers, we're told to lean in, right? And to take what's ours. And that's also individualistic. It's not thinking, how do we get together as a class, really, especially women as a class, and start to you know, connect and talk openly about our situation and try to change things.
Lee, thanks for the call. We'll go next to Delia in Three Lakes. Delia, hi.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. I have a comment regarding a short maternity leave. It's only, unfortunately for my employer, it's only 3 months, so 6 weeks paid and 6 weeks is unpaid. And I'm originally from Russia. I know they give them about maternity leave. I chose to breastfeed my baby, and it was very hard because I worked as a critical care transport nurse, so couldn't really pump much when you're in the back of the ambulance with a patient. So very challenging to provide the best care for your child and try to maintain that salary.
Delia, thanks so much for sharing that. She mentioned breast pumping, and that's been an issue. You talk about women airline pilots trying to deal with this issue, Alyssa.
Yeah, I talked to a couple of people who worked in jobs where they were sort of there was no clean spaces for them to pump. They said, "Oh, you can do it in the bathroom," or they sometimes set aside strange rooms off to the side in, say, in an airport, which didn't really answer the question. So that's a very parallel to your experience. And I mean, basically, there's not very much protection for these experiences. So they say, "Okay, go back to work." You know, you can pump in this, you know, in the bathroom, and that's just not really good enough. We need more pumping stations everywhere.
Thanks for that call. One issue we haven't gotten into that I wanted to touch on, Alyssa, is the risk of automation. And if this affects people working and middle class and a lot of jobs that people might not have thought could be automated. So, again, as you say, if people do things right, their job might not exist anymore after a while.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's also going to affect women predominantly. There's a new study that showed that, you know, 57% of the jobs that are going to be lost are going to be female workers. And one thing that interested me was these were often middle class professions that were threatened by the robots. It wasn't just, you know, retail work, which is already, like, if you go to a supermarket, right, you may be checking it out with an automated checker. It was things like there's pharmacists, there's robot pharmacists, there's robots doing the work of lawyers, and yes, doing the work of journalists. They have there's a program called Automated Insights, which to me is an oxymoron, but and it's doing it's providing so-called, you know, content for news services like Forbes.
Very briefly, Alyssa, are people talking about these things beyond your book and the response to it?
I feel like people are starting to. I've been really happy to see articles. Like, there was a recent article in the New York Times about wages not keeping up. You know, like, oh, this is a moment of prosperity, but it's mostly corporate wealth. It's not wages, and prices are still really high. I just want people to refocus on what life is actually like on the ground for many people, and I don't know. I've been feeling optimistic. Also, there's a lot of new talk about universal basic income, which would be a certain amount that might be given to members of the population. That's being piloted in Stockton, California, and also in Ontario, in Canada. And I feel like that is now getting traction. It was, you know, Obama's mentioning it. Fox, it was on Fox today.
We'll have to leave it there. Thanks to Alyssa Quart. We've been talking about her new book. It's called Squeeze, Why Our Families Can't Afford America. Here's a fun game that's out there on the internet, and you can play along at home. A Twitter user issued this challenge to a film critic, quoting, "You can replace the cast of any movie with The Muppets, but you keep one of the human actors. What movie and which human do you keep?" Some of the fun answers included The Truman Show, keep Jim Carrey as the human. Any Bruce Lee movie, keep Bruce Lee. Jurassic Park, keep Jeff Goldblum. The Empire Strikes Back, keep Yoda. Well, Bill Martin's producer is in here. We asked him what movie he would tackle, and there's only one movie you ever talk about, Bill.
And that would be Home Alone, because that's pretty much one of like six movies that I've seen. Home Alone 2 is one of the other ones.
Right, right. And so what do you do? Who gets to stay human and not be replaced by a Muppet in your version of Home Alone?
I'm keeping John Candy because John Candy is just the funniest guy in that movie. And I'm thinking of him interacting with some of the Muppets in there. And that just has comedic gold written all over it to me.
Okay. So. He mostly interacts only with Catherine O'Hara, though, in the van.
Pretty much, yeah.
Okay. But now you've assigned some Muppets, I think, to key roles.
Yeah, I'm thinking, I originally thought Animal possibly could play Kevin, but then I thought about it a little bit more, and I thought Animal might actually be a little bit
One
better
note.
For Buzz, being
okay.
the big, you know, brother. Plus, Animal doesn't talk all that much. I was also thinking what is that guy's name? Well, Rachel Vasquez came up with the two guys in the balcony to be...
Staller
the,
and Waldorf.
Yep, to be Harry and Marv, the robbers. Sam the Eagle, I think, kind of looks like Uncle Frank.
Okay.
There's possibilities there.
Coming soon to theaters near us. You could play along at Central Time, WPA.